Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Okay, welcome back to Roadcase, everybody. This is your host, Josh Rosenberg. I'm so psyched to be here for this week's episode featuring an interview I did with Drew Simmons, who's with Foundations Artist Management and manages, among others, Noah Kahn. And it's just a really exciting time for Drew. Really psyched to have him on the show. So glad you're around for this one. And I wanted to remind you that there's a number of different ways that you can get involved in the Roadcase community. Really quick and easy way is to give us a follow on the socials. We're at Roadcase Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you have any questions or comments, you can shoot us an email at info@roadcasepod.com. Or if you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can do that on our website, www.roadcasepod.com. Also, a great way to help support Roadcase is to follow us on your favorite listening platform. On Spotify, just click that box that says follow right there at the Roadcase homepage. On Apple Podcasts, there's a check mark up in the upper right-hand corner. And doing that will allow you to receive live updates when new episodes come into the world. And while you're there, you can rate and review Roadcase as well. On Spotify, there's a little box with some stars underneath that follow box. Just click on that, and an Apple Podcast, just scroll up a bunch from the homepage. You'll see some stars and a place to write a review. Really helps out the show. Just leave us your thoughts on the show or what have you. Really appreciate those that have, and thanks so much for following Roadcase on the platforms and on socials. So I had a really great conversation with artist manager Drew Simmons. Drew is a partner at Foundations Artist Management. He works out of Nashville. His biggest client is Noah Kahn, who's one of the most successful artists of 2023 and who was Grammy nominated in the Best New Artist category for the most recent Grammys. Foundations Artist Management and Drew specifically also manage Coin, Dayglow, and producers, writers, Gabe Simon and Carrie Kay. Drew managed the band Young the Giant from 2010 to 2023. Other artists on the Foundations Artist Management roster include Dr. Dog, Dispatch, Foy Vance, Laufey, and a band that I recently had on the show, The Brook and the Bluff. So those are just a couple of them. They have an amazing roster of artists at that company. Drew grew up in Buffalo, New York, and really worked his way up through the ranks, really never saying no to an opportunity throughout his entire career. Initially interned at Righteous Babe Records, which is the label run by Annie DeFranco in his hometown of Buffalo. Then Drew went to Northeastern University in Boston, worked a number of different jobs, worked at venues, did security at venues, worked at the box office, was a runner, did so many different things. It was just so fascinating to talk to him about his amazing career and how he just had a really amazing desire to be in the industry and did whatever he could at every turn to do that, and finally got into artist management and gained his own clients, namely Young the Giant. But his association with Noah is just legendary. The story of how he met Noah and began that relationship 9 years ago is the thing that will go down in history. And Drew is really a coach, an advisor, and who really respects the art form that his artists put out there. He's really an amazing advocate for his artists, and we talk about that a little bit because it's really a level of managing humans who produce these amazing artistic and creative outputs that really make them so special. So Drew also helps Noah with the Busy Head Project, which raises money for mental health and donates a portion of all ticket sales to local mental health organizations, which is really just amazing. And if you'd like to find out information about Noah Kahn, and he's about to embark on a massive North American tour and European tour, you can visit his website for more information about tickets and those dates. Thanks so much for being around for this episode. Really happy to have you here for this one. And I want to send a special shout out and thank you to Drew Simmons for being here on this episode of Road Case. And here we go. Hey, Drew, thanks for being on the show, man. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Sorry about the Bills. You're from Buffalo, right?
I am from Buffalo. A diehard Bills fan.
I can see the when your voice went, I'm from Buffalo.
That would go, inflection would go up if we were winning more often, but we have Josh Allen. And
yeah, why does Buffalo, it's always like, I'm from Buffalo.
I love Buffalo. It is the city of good neighbors for a reason. It is a fantastic Midwestern town.
You consider it a Midwestern town?
By vibe. Yeah, absolutely. Western New York is, might as well be Cleveland. So as far as the attitude, as far as the personality. So
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Is your whole family from there from like years back and stuff?
Yeah. My wife, everybody,
cool.
We're raising a couple diehard Bills fans and my kids.
What was the vibe in the house? Was it Saturday or Sunday? I can't remember. I watched all the games, actually. I was with my son. I was in Maine, speaking of like smaller, like, I was like out of Chicago at the time. I watched all the games with him this weekend, which is like I'd never do that. But so I'm fully on board with the playoffs this year.
I have a 6-year-old son right now and a 4-year-old daughter, and the 6-year-old son has gotten really into football, particularly the Bills, and is obsessed. And, throughout the season, he's kind of come to terms with some losing, but it was better than it was early on when we were starting to lose in the middle of the season. So, lessons.
You can't win them all, kid.
Yep, exactly.
But have you brought him on board to the the dubious record of 4 Super Bowl appearances without a win?
Oh yeah, he's deep diving through YouTube all Bills history.
Oh God, so painful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Who was the
character?
All right. Before we get into this, who was the quarterback back then?
Jim Kelly.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Name a couple other good guys on the team.
Thurman Thomas, Bruce Smith.
Right. All right. We won't talk about OJ.
No,
the years. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Quite a, quite an illustrious history in Buffalo, but
mm-hmm.
You're here now. You're currently a partner at Foundations Artist Management and manage none other than Noah Kahn, whose just popularity has skyrocketed. And one of the things I found interesting was that, like, a lot of people think this has been an overnight success, but
it's not,
right?
It's been the 9-year overnight success.
Yeah. Why does it always seem, it just seems like that, because like there's this, you get to that critical mass where so many people know about him and hadn't heard of him before. And is it frustrating for you when people just assume that, oh shit, this is how it happens? Like, this guy was like zero. And then I guess it's sort of transparent from your perspective.
No, it's not frustrating at all. I mean, it's just how it goes, right? Like there's, so much happening in the world lately, and so much, media to consume, that not everyone's going to come across every artist. And so I think the fact that he had a successful touring career, for he was building it for the 7 or 8 years leading up to this record, and probably playing 2,000 capacity, 3,000 capacity venues, UK, Europe, US, Australia, had a couple gold records. And he was pretty content with his career as far as the status of it. And he was, full-time musician for years. But what he was growing less content with over time was the music he was making and how it reflected his identity. And, you know,
That's important though. You see, you blew through that.
The music he's creating and how it reflects his identity and how, you know, the art he was creating and putting out into the world was, he was kind of growing further apart from the style of songwriting he originally started with in his career. And it took the pandemic to, send him along with everyone, home. And he went back to his parents' place up in Stratford, Vermont, which is a town of 1,000 people, mm-hmm. Pretty close to New Hampshire border near Hanover, New Hampshire. And they live on, you know, lots of acres and lots of hiking trails. And he went home and kind of reflected on his life. And what came out of that was this desire to be closer to the music that inspired him growing up. And, you know, that was Cat Stevens, that was singer-songwriters, that was folkier inspired mm-hmm. music. Paul Simon was a huge inspiration to him. And so, you know, that he kind of followed his heart, followed his gut in that kind of world-changing, life-changing moment. And, you know, the process of that is one where he started getting really real with his lyrics. He's always been an amazing lyricist, but that's kind of one of his strengths. But he started writing a record about his hometown and his relationship with his hometown and his parents and his parents' divorce and, you know, his love hate dynamic with where he was from. So I think that resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah. Is that, now, it's an interesting story about how you discovered him on SoundCloud years ago and then went up and visited him because he, like, didn't believe you that you were that this would be fucking for real. I love that. But
yeah, he thought it was fake.
Yeah, of course. why would he think otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, it was just some dude reaching out to him on Facebook Messenger or something. That's how I got in touch with him. But yeah, it's funny.
But so at that point, from your perspective, the kernel that you saw or the raw material that you'd seen, whatever that was, right? Is that what he's doing now and kind of came back to, or was it more of that Pompey thing? And he's like, is what he's doing now, is that, how does that compare to what you had seen way back then? Like just taking out that sort of the direction that he started to go in before the pandemic.
Absolutely. This is the most honest and close to who he is that he's put into his music.
This is what you thought that this is what the thing that you believed in.
Absolutely. Yeah. I came across a song called Sync, which was kind of the gateway into Noah's world. And
Sync, he was like just getting together with something, not the kitchen of the kitchen variety.
S-I-N-K.
Oh, sink. Okay. All right. Yeah. Oh, sink. Yeah. Okay. Like going down the tubes or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And that was, he was just turning 18 years old at that point, deciding to either go to college or not. And, you know, he had something about his lyricism and his voice that I kept going back to over and over again. And, this is a more matured version of that, but, a more, you know, experienced version of that. He's traveled the world and, you know, back to the overnight success, you know, perception. It's like, it's critical, I feel like, to have those life experiences to be able to write about them and have that perspective. So, you know, I think that the, you know, years leading up to this recent success, was very important.
Yeah. I thought about the overnight success thing and like, that's always going to happen because, you know, you don't sell out Fenway and Madison Square Garden where you have everybody that's known him for 10 years. Those are the people that were filling up the 3,000, 2,000 seat cap venues, right? There's always going to be others that have known him. I don't know. I talked to him about my daughter. My middle daughter is 21. She's a senior at Tulane. She's like, oh yeah, dad. I know Noah Kahan. There's a TikTok thing or something like that about the sticks, something. So there's that viral thing that starts to just roll. But that has those other aspects of the popularity snowball surprised you in that sense, or is that kind of it must be a newer phenomenon for artists?
Not really. Side note, also, he was enrolled in Tulane and decided to not go.
Yeah. Oh, I don't, did she mention that to me? When was it? So wait, so he's like late 20s now. So like 10 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was about 9 years ago.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. But, the question was it, is it the phenomenon kind of,
yeah, or some of those factors, unique, like newer yeah. factors that you hadn't seen before. And there's some new that creates that mass, appeal and interest.
No. And I think we were seeing that just across the industry as, you know, social media and particularly TikTok was coming into, you know, its own, where it started as, you know, dance trends and became way more diverse and mature yeah. than that. And Noah's hilarious. He has a very blunt personality and he's very down to earth, says things that, you know, most people are, you know, embarrassed to say.
Yeah. I read something where he's like, you were like, he put out a tweet and you're like, God, they could never have come out. I read this, like they could never have come out with that in a boardroom, but the topic was you can't control what artists say. And that's the beauty of being an artist, that at some point from your own management perspective, and we'll talk about how, what your style is and what your thoughts are on, massaging or controlling or not controlling, letting go. I thought that was interesting, but go ahead. Sorry, I had to interject that.
Yeah, no, there are things that, you know, Noah's, we always were pushing him towards social media because he's so good at it. Like he's just himself. He is open. He is vulnerable. He is raw. And he's very, very funny. So we are always like, if you did more of this, it would really catch on. And, you know, no artist gets into music thinking they want to be a celebrity or be a content creator, right? They want to be an artist. They want to be a musician. And so kind of coming to terms with that existence or coexistence of social media presence, public perception and art is something that was unnatural at first to him. And then what came down to is he was so invested in this album emotionally and gave everything he had to it, into the evolution of his sound, that he was all of a sudden really happy to do it. And he was, you know, engaging in ways that, you know, we couldn't have convinced him to do in the past because it was just coming from his own, you know, his own being. Yeah.
That led to do it in a variety of different ways.
Exactly. Yeah. And then just took off, you know, because, you know, we can't craft that for him. It's his personality.
Do a lot of those outlets were like hyper developed and it got like a lot of hyper focus because those were the only outlets during the pandemic. Was that something, have you seen that? Is that like, that's something I'm sort of just been recently thinking about, is how, you know, not only it took everybody off the road clearly, but, and was a incredibly difficult time for all artists, but then it just forced everyone to like figure out different ways of engagement.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. There was a point in time where live streaming, no artist wanted to do it.
Right.
They had no other option. Right.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, across all of our roster, but you know, all of the peers we work with, you know, we're trying to navigate that, simultaneously navigate, you know, other technologies that were coming out of that time that, you know, didn't really stick. And, you know, they were just like, what do we do now? That was a huge question.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do we advise our clients when we ourselves, you know, we're trying to figure things out and no one knew the answers. So, it was definitely, I feel like the, not just Noah, but all artists were craving that outlet that they had become so used to. It was just a big part of their dynamic, is the audience, you know, relationship. So that, I think people were seeking it. And thankfully, as soon as you got back out to playing shows again and being in person, it, you know, those things kind of quieted down because there is a shelf life to how many times you can do Instagram Live.
Have you seen Watershed Moment? Is that, yeah, exactly. There's only so many plays you can do. I mean, it's pretty cool. Like, you know, I like it. It's fun when artists do it and like do it in different times and give you kind of, you know, like BTS, man. It's all about BTS sometimes, behind the scenes stuff, you know, it's kind of fun.
Totally. But podcasting, you know, also had an explosion that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you know, because this conversation can happen endlessly. The artist sitting in their room playing acoustic guitar with limited resources, it has a certain ceiling and there's, you know, not as much
podcast improv. Forever, man.
There you go.
Did they tell you to say that here, Drew?
No. But it's true. If you think about like all the media that came out of the last couple of years and how much more you know, omnipresent, you know, podcasts are now. It's, they had a big explosion.
Yeah. Yeah. I just hope people sit and listen to them at home more, you know, continue, please continue to listen to podcasts, everybody, especially Roadcase.
Yes.
All right. So we'll come back to Drew and to Noah, and I'm going to mess up those names because your biggest client had to have a first name that started with four letters too. So thanks for that.
All good.
So we'll come back to Noah because he's not the only artist that you manage, and you've had a really interesting career. So let's talk about your background a little bit. Annie DeFranco figured into that. She's from Buffalo. And yep. Then you interned at her record label, Righteous Babes. And we've got to go into the James Brown story as well, which is super interesting. But can you just tell me, just give me a kind of a brief rundown on sort of who Drew is and what's up? And
So I grew up playing soccer, went and played college soccer, and was either going to go soccer route or music route. Oakland University in Detroit.
Okay.
And it was always kind of like hyper-focused, get the D1 scholarship, go that route. And got there, you know, realized that, you know, the committing my whole life to that was a little bit daunting, and there's much more of a career in music. And
your knees survived, though.
Knees survived, never got injured, thankfully. But there was much more of a career path in music. And I'd always been a massive music fan, grew up in a very, my parents were very much, you know, huge consumers of music. And my dad was an audiophile and was very geeking out on his speaker systems whenever he could, and listening to vinyl all the time. And so I was always kind of in the collector's mode, in the consumption mode, but you know, never played anything, but kind of was always curious about the business side of things. So, I'd go to shows and I would just look around at the production and the people, you know, working at the show and wonder how they got that job or what their job entails. And it's kind of led me, I'd always kind of had a bit of an entrepreneurial, itch, I guess, is always there. And so I'd always, you know, just be curious with the business of things. And
what kind of business did your folks do?
My dad was, worked in nonprofit housing in inner city of Buffalo.
Good for him.
My mom worked, as a recruiter of doctors. So she had the job of trying to get doctors come to Buffalo.
So here's a heavy coat and a good paycheck.
Exactly. Bring them in the summertime. That's what they did.
Yeah, so, you think.
Annie DeFranco was a huge part of my, you know, I had a lot of musical inspirations growing up, but my sister introduced me to her. She was older, is older. And I, you know, went to a couple of her shows. She happened to be local. Nobody else is running a music, you know, management company out of Buffalo. And Annie was very independent, had her own label, and had her own management team under the same roof. So I found my way into convincing my best friend's father, who happened to be the landlord of the building that they rented their office space from, to go knock on their door and say, "Hey, can you, you know, pay your rent and also, you know, maybe consider my son's friend as an intern?" So thankfully they were open to it, and I packed poster tubes and shipped out her e-com, you know, merch orders, and then eventually found my way into to talking to everyone there and making some friends and, you know, offering up whatever I could do to anyone else that worked there, and just kind of turn into like a part-time paid gig. And eventually went to Northeastern University in Boston I transferred there to go to the music industry program, and kind of just carried relationships with me from that first internship and that first job. And one of Ani's tour manager's father ran a security company in Boston. And she's like, "Hey, if you're going to Boston, talk to my dad and maybe he'll give you a job, you know, part-time security."
Specifically venue security.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You don't strike me as some beefy, burly guy, but who knows? I can only see you from shoulders up.
It doesn't take a lot to work your way up in a security company.
Yeah, it's not like a bouncer or something. I guess.
Yeah. I wasn't bouncing as much as seeing a lot of shows is what I was doing. And that gave me an opportunity. I'd work 5 shows a week and worked all the different venues all throughout Boston, you know, small, medium, and large. And just kind of opened my eyes to all of the jobs in the live touring sector. And kind of that turned into working with what is now Live Nation on the production side. So I was a runner. And for anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's basically the gopher of the local production staff. So, you know, you have to pick up people from the airport, drive them around town, get the artist to the hotel, run errands for them.
Let me stop you at Live Nation. Let's go back to the security thing though. Tell me a little bit about what that entailed. Like what was up with that?
It basically entailed, and
also just for some timing context. So that was what, like
2002.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I graduated Northeastern in 2004.
Okay. So the security thing was like just working with the company itself, but being on site at venues, and you'd shift from venue to venue depending on the promoter or whomever was dealing with that part of the that aspect of the show.
Yeah, that particular security company was contracted. They pretty much did all of Live Nation's shows, which at the time it was called Don Law Presents in Boston.
Oh yeah.
That's how they had the opportunity to work all different size shows. They would do anything that Live Nation was doing in the market. And so it depended on the size of the show, but occasionally I would be sitting in the barricade, you know, or occasionally I'd be, you know, at the front door, you know, doing pat downs. And then eventually I was, you know, managing small teams of personnel. And then eventually I was managing, certain shows, like running the security for, I was the, you know, manager of the show, the security manager of the show for the Rolling Stones, and they played the Orpheum Theater in Boston in 2003. Like just some really cool experiences that, sometimes I would shadow the artists and be the personal, you know, security, locally if they didn't have one that they're touring with.
Right.
So, you know, it was a lot of crowd interaction and just
what an amazing experience at that time. So you were going to school and doing that.
Yeah, I was going to school and, you know, in the music industry program, and my roommates were partying and I was working at shows.
Yeah. But you were doing, you were having the most fun though. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. A lot of fun.
So the Stone, tell me about the Stone show. That must be pretty memorable.
Very. They were at the time, I forgot the name of the tour, but they were doing a tour where they played a theater, an arena, and a stadium in every market. So we had the chance to work with them through, you know, the multiple shows. Yeah. One of
the three that occurred in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the Orpheum and then what?
It was the Orpheum, it was the Garden, and then it was Fenway Park.
So you did the Orpheum component.
The Orpheum component, I did all of them actually, but the Orpheum component was, actually that night was, because I was managing the security team that night, Bill Murray was a guest and, he was at the show.
A guest of the show to spectate.
He came to the show.
Yeah.
And because he's Bill Murray and needed a little more security attention so the fans wouldn't mess with him.
Yeah.
We needed someone to stand next to Bill Murray the whole time. So I did that.
Oh, cool. Did you chat with him? Did you chat with him?
No, I don't want to bother him too much, but it was just fun.
So, yeah, sure.
The arena show wasn't very eventful. Normal show, the arena, it was great, but Fenway Park was amazing because we had a chance to be there. There was a multi-day stage build out at Fenway because whenever you play a show, they have to bring everything in and create it in the outfield. So they came in and they were sound checking, you know, playing the whole show to, you know, 40 of us at Fenway. Cool. Yeah. So we get a chance to be there for that and then be there for the actual, you know, the actual show as well.
Cool. Wow. Major highlight for you?
One of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. There must be just so many. All right. We'll go over some other highlights too. 100%.
Cool.
But then you connected with Live Nation because you were, how did that occur?
Because Live Nation, because the security company was working all the shows Live Nation was promoting, we became friendly with this, you know, you see the same faces there all the time, right?
Yeah.
And so I just kind of became friendly with the Live Nation production team, which is local production manager and the promoter reps. And so I was able to just, you know, find my way into the lowest rung on the ladder, and, you know, work part-time there. So I started balancing being a showrunner and a production assistant and a ticket scanner, and also the security stuff. So I kind of pieced it all together.
Okay. And how long were you at Live Nation?
I ended up finding my way into the like corporate office as well. I was the runner for their office as well as some of their shows. And then I assisted in their college booking department as well. I kind of just said yes to everything. And so I thought, you know, I got to get as much experience as possible. And they're willing to give it to me. So made some really good friends there. But I think I graduated in 2004, backpacked around Europe for a little bit, and then started working for Mark Cates at Fenway Recordings, who has a company in Boston named Fenway that is primarily a manager now. But at the time he was at Geffen during the Nirvana days in the A&R department. He signed Glassjaw and a couple other rock bands. And then he moved back to Boston to raise his family to launch Fenway. And that was like 2005. And this is all like, you know, the height of Napster and file sharing and downloading, you know, the dawn of iTunes.
Yeah.
And so it was not the greatest time to start a record label, especially independently with your own money. And so he quickly started co-managing artists, primarily artists from the UK, one of which was a band called Doves, which I absolutely loved. Mm-hmm. He also was managing Mission of Burma and the Cribs and Louis the 14th. And so he was a local manager with a global experience. And I was at the time, which I didn't mention, but I was working security and working for Live Nation. And I also convinced a local artist that I could manage them. And we had some success, you know, selling, you know, 500 to 1,000 tickets in the New England region. And so I was learning how to be a manager kind of from the ground up. And he saw me doing that. And he asked if I wanted to work for him and the day-to-day manager for him, which was kind of the junior manager.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you like rolled from one thing to the other, but when you were like working security and sort of in that world early, when you were still in college, was there like a piece of this? Were you always sort of like, well, eventually I want to be in management and there's nothing wrong with that. Clearly you just like rolled into the next thing and like figured out kind of just what presented itself. You were saying not saying no to anything.
Yeah, I definitely was curious about the management position as soon as I saw, at the time it was Scott Fisher, who was Ani DiFranco's manager. I saw that role and I was curious about it. And then when I went to Northeastern, there was an artist management class as part of the curriculum, and it was being taught by a professor who was an active artist manager, and he was managing Howie Day. And Howie Day at the time had a huge hit. And it was like Howie and John Mayer were both kind of, you know, the exploding as the male singer songwriters at the time. Uh-huh. And so I got a chance to, through that class, get some like case studies of how things were happening in real time with Howie, and just kind of piqued my curiosity even further. And that's where I decided to go pursue a local act and try to, you know, get them to allow me to help them, which, you know, was anything from creating an LLC to helping them buy a van to driving that van from show to show.
Right.
But it was getting my kind of cutting my teeth in the management space.
What I find interesting about management is that it's not only a business perspective that you need to know what to do, where to do it, what's the latest, what your kind of gut feeling is. You got to have good sort of sense of what the best thing is to do at any one moment and be able to look at the big business case. But there's also that human element to it. Oh shit. Sorry. I'm going to have to edit that shit out. I've never done that before.
While you're at it, I'm going to drink some coffee so we can not edit that out either.
Oh yeah. Yeah, sure. That's okay. We're allowed to drink stuff. Right. I cool. constantly have like popping my coffee cup open here and I was editing.
Oh, nice.
What I find interesting is the human element of management, and there you're dealing with an incredibly humanistic industry. Like there is business, but like I'm a fan of artists, you know, and that's who I talk to on this show all the, you know, primarily, but you know, and it's something that you're really dealing with so many deep elements of the human and artistic experience and making sure that that's represented as best possible. And I know I have a completely naive view, but I liked, but it's an art form, and you're dealing with a human who's an artist and has something. We're dealing with humans that are artists and have very special things to offer, but there's also kind of an emotional and psychological cost to that as well, which you need to address. Can you talk to me a little bit about that human element and how you sort of, obviously there's different managers out there, but how is that human element kind of present in what you do?
It's everything. Really, it is the core of everything. And, you know, artistic expression is so deep and like heavy for all artists, whether you're creating, you know, upbeat pop music or selling, you know, folk music. It doesn't, you know, change the fact that you're expressing yourself, and that creates vulnerability and it creates insecurities. And, you know, you have to kind of navigate the intersection of art and emotion and commerce and ambition. And I find that to be the most fulfilling part of it, of being a manager and doing what I do, is I am able to impact art and, you know, have a fingerprint on culture. And at the same time, like, I'm an artist advocate. Like, that's my job. It's to advocate for them. They hire me to, you know, from a business sense, they hire me to be their CEO, but they hire me to also, you know, emotionally help them through this entire endeavor, which, you know, I think if I had more of a psychology background, I'd probably be better suited for the actual job than my education. But there's trend analysis, there's, you know, gut instinct, there's, you know, just understanding how art and culture are shifting and trying to be on the front edge of that it's really exciting. And I think the interaction with the artists is by nature, management, you can't manage a ton of artists all at once because you're so integrated into their lives, into their existence. You're quarterbacking their whole team, which could be, you know, anywhere from 10 people to 200 around the world. And, you know, when you have a global touring artist and a global recording artist like that, you're dealing with different time zones, you're dealing with, you know, different cultures, you're dealing with how to integrate your artist and their art into cultures that are foreign to, you know, the conception of that art. So it's not easy. It's actually really hard, but it's definitely not boring. That's for sure. So,
yeah. And your input is so important for the artists that you manage. Do you have different you must have sort of, talk to me about like how it organically shapes up between you and an artist to eventually land on what kind of level of input you have in their careers, that and how much they listen to you, for lack of a better term for that.
Yeah.
It's got to differ from artist to artist, right? And do you kind of have those, is it sort of unspoken agreements, or do you say like you have sit downs and like, okay, this is how much I'm going to do, and this is how much you have to listen to me, sort of, for just to be brief about it?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately I'm an advisor, right? So they don't have to take my advice.
Right.
They can ignore my advice. If that happens consistently, we probably aren't on the same page.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But I am deferent to the artist's opinion in most cases, in that they need space to create art. They need a comfortable environment to do it. They need a supportive environment to do it. They need a challenging environment to do it. And I'm, you know, at times you have to be the coach and you have to, you know, tell them to run one more lap they don't want to run. But at the same time, you know, I have to stop and think and say, this is not my creation. I'm a very, very close collaborator with the artist. But each artist, as you're saying, does treat their management relationship differently.
Yeah.
And, you know, it becomes even more complicated when there's multiple artists involved in one group. So you're working with a band that could be two, it could be five people. And, you know, depending on the dynamics of that band, they
might have their own informal kind of, they got their mishigas and their like their whole,
absolutely,
the groupies and the this and the that and the friends and the right.
Yeah. Like the, you know, the bigger the artist, the more people that are in their orbit, but at the same time, you have to be comfortable releasing control, right? Like there's so many parallels to parenting, frankly. Whereas like you're guiding,
you can only do so much.
You're not, you know, always handholding. So, I think, you know, the best dynamics with an artist and a manager is when there's mutual respect and, you know, space for the artist to express themselves, to be themselves, but also the manager to be heard in the process.
Yeah. I mean, it's similar to parenting, but in artist management, parachuting in is not considered a bad thing and you got to do it sometimes, right?
Yeah.
I would assume sometimes you just have to insert yourself if you see things going on.
Yeah. Inserting yourself happens all the time, more so when you are the in-between with a third party, right? Like you're dealing with a director on a video shoot or a producer in the studio or executives of the label or a brand you're dealing with. You are the mouthpiece for the artist and you filter a lot of things into them. So, you know, you have to know what that artist is going to like and what they don't like and what they're willing to do and what they're not willing to do and be able to say no. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, if you're at a photo shoot and the photographer is putting the artist in a weird position or making them uncomfortable in some way, it's often up to us to interject and say, you know, let's change this, you know? So you're kind of the protector in some ways too.
I'm kind of laughing because I keep thinking of Ari Gold in this scenario. You know?
that's exaggerated scenario.
It is, of course. Yeah. It's such a larger than life kind of, you know, characterization of the worst and kind of the best too, you know?
Yeah.
The phenomenal show. I go back to that every couple of years and watch the whole thing because it's just, it's iconic.
Yeah, in that case, you know, that's dealing with actors, but
there's some similarities.
E is more the manager figure, and Ari is more.
That's the agent side, but still, the parachute. It was the parachuting part that got to it. So, talk to me about that intermediary level that you serve, because you got make the analogy, you got downstream, you've got your artists, and upstream, you've got everybody else that they're kind of dealing with. On the upstream, you know, the promoters, like you said, directors, others, label, the labels. What's the most difficult relationship that you have to deal with on the upside? What presents like the most challenges for you?
That's more, I guess, personality driven.
And
agenda driven too, because the thing about the music industry is always changing and there's always different agendas and there's lots of people involved in decision making, especially as it becomes larger and global. You know, the biggest challenge is really time management, frankly, and being able to, you know, find time for everything. That's our time, experience is our resource. And so I think there are projects where dealing with the record label as the marketing and financing division of the artist business is difficult if we don't see eye to eye with them. Or, you know, oftentimes you could sign a deal with a publisher or a label and the person you signed with, who, you know, you invested in and they invested in you, gets a different job and goes somewhere else. And that person's now gone and you have a whole new team to deal with and navigate. You know, I think
Changes in personnel are definitely challenging in anything. Yeah.
Exactly.
Some guy leaves, 100%. You're like, oh fuck, we got to start over again. Or I hope the new guy
Yep. But you know, the cyclical nature of music, you know, artists creating albums or creating a series of singles or, you know, having different eras of their career is, you know, you kind of reinvent yourself along the way. And, the one of the major challenges is like stringing those reinventions together to have a long arcing career, and doing it successfully. And I think that is a huge challenge when an artist is like, I've done this, I have to go do something else. I don't want to repeat it. I don't want to go back to the well over and over again. And, you know, that evolution of the audience perception of what they believe or they go to that artist for may not be in line with where the artist is going personally and musically. I think that presents a whole series of challenges along the way creatively.
Yeah. And how much does, that's an interesting component. I mean, that, does that keep you up at night sometimes? Like, just like they're going in a direction you're sort of, I'm not sure, but that's another thing we talked about that before. You just can't control their artists are going to, the artists be artists and they're just going to, they're going to do their thing. You know, you just hope that you have a sense of what the fan base is, and fan bases tend to be pretty loyal. I know, you know, being a fan of some bands and like, I know what people say when they go in a certain direction, I'm like, just let them be artists, you know? Okay. Maybe you didn't like the latest album, let's say, but hey, you know, it's like, that's what you have to be on board for if you're a really real fan of music.
Yeah. But also the consumer's taste changes too. Right. So like, you know, that could be trend influenced or could just be like personally influenced. You might've had a metal phase and now you're in a pop phase, whatever it might be. And so, you know, it goes both ways. Right. And people evolve and they change. And I think the artist having the leniency within their fan base where they're invested enough to be along for those ups and downs or twists and turns is critical. And I think I've found myself gravitating towards artists over my career that, you know, maybe aren't just pure pop or just like top 40 in their sound, because that's such a difficult thing to keep the ball in the air over, you know, a decade or longer, because that those trends change super fast. And, you know, in what's in vogue now is not, you know, a year later. And so try to seek, I just personally am drawn to music that I think is, doesn't have those components to it as much, but, but that is just also my personal taste. So, I think, you know, working with artists that can tour for a long time and, you know, develop real meaningful relationships with their audience is critical.
Yeah. One commonality I've seen with some of the artists that you've represented is there is sort of, and of course it's all subjective, man. Like, you know, it's all just personal taste, but I come into it kind of thinking, oh, it's a little poppy for me. And it's kind of like very glossy. But like I said, about when I was listening to Noah earlier, like my earlier experience with him, but then scratching the surface, and that had to do with Dayglow and Coin also, there's a real level of substance there underneath. So I applaud you for that. And it really, those are artists, all of them that, and I haven't listened to Carrie Kay also, whom you represent, just, you know, to be honest, but there's sort of an underlying like hyper quality that rewards that rewards multiple listens.
Thanks. Yeah. I you know, I personally like music that is melody driven. I like melody.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I also like lyric. And so I think, yeah, I tend to have a taste that has some commercial appeal to it, but I don't venture hyper top 40 pop as much as I do. I enjoy trying to thread the needle. And like you said, like I really want substance. I want to right now, particularly, you know, to me, the most exciting artists ones that have something to say. And, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for that, culturally and kind of where we are in this point in history right now. But I think artists that, and this is partially why Noah's having such success right now, is, you know, there's meaning, there's illustrative lyrics. And, I think it's sometimes hard to do that when it just, you're going for like a certain like dance beat, you know? So, I think, you know, that aspect of, you know, working with artists that can kind of not just be one thing, but be a variety of things is also exciting.
Yeah. It's when you talk about the lyrical content, and then I thought about kind of Fenway Park and like what that must mean to you. Like, what's that? What do you like just sitting there knowing that you sold it out like in minutes or whatever it was, not only that, but just like playing there and like, it's just, talk to me about what kind of comes up for you.
Yeah. I mean, my now wife at the time, girlfriend, lived in the Fens and, in Boston, and she went to BU and out to Northeastern. And, I was living in Mission Hill, which is not too far from there. And I, you know, the Red Sox were everything to Boston. Right. So like being such a New England, you know, cornerstone, and then working with a with an artist who is making a record that is exclusively about New England experience, have the opportunity to get to the status of being able to play Fenway Park is truly a career highlight for both of us. Yeah. And for the entire team, frankly. But there's so few artists that have the opportunity to play Fenway. And the fact that we sold it out in minutes and added a second show and the same thing again, sold out in minutes, it was, you know, but unfortunately, we didn't have enough time in our schedule to do more shows. We probably could have, but that is mind-blowing. It's truly mind-blowing. Like, there was nothing about the making of this record that at any point Noah, myself, or the producer, Gabe Simon, who I also happen to manage, it said, we're playing Fenway Park. This song is getting us Fenway Park.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, wait, if someone had said that at the point, what would you have said?
We would have laughed. Yeah. You know, we would have been like, yes, like there's always lofty ambitions in music, right? You know, this is a industry.
They're dreamers. Yeah. But yeah,
absolutely. And like, you know, you can never laugh them off entirely because it happens. Right. But like, there is a realness to the process and the road to get there and the rare air that you're in when you are in those situations. So, hey, like, you know, couldn't be happier to be in the situation. And I tell you one thing, Noah is not taking it for granted at all. I mean, he is so happy about the chance to do that. It means a lot to his family. I was born in Burlington, Vermont. You know, Noah's family being from, you know, from Vermont and living there still, you know, it just means everything to them.
How do you keep him grounded, like, in that? Like, do you have to work to keep people grounded?
Not Noah. No, yeah. Not Noah. He's self-deprecating and hilarious. And if anything, he reminds us to be, you know, human. So I think he's amazing at that.
That's so great. Congratulations, man.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. And not only that, I don't know if we've mentioned the new artist Grammy nomination. Did we talk about that at the beginning? We've gone through so much.
Yeah.
I thought that was, I didn't know if we were recorded that. Yeah. We talked about it before we came on, but yeah. Like, since we're on, you know, this massive tour that's going on in the United States. And by the way, and also I just want to mention for the audience, like, he's in Australia right now. I think this is like in a Saturday night is like the last show or Sunday night from this Australia. Mm-hmm. And he's super popular in Australia. And I was reading somewhere. It's like how mind blowing it was that this kid from Vermont is like the, one of the first places where he kind of took hold was all the way across the world. Like, that's that's incredible in and of itself. Just like the commonality of the human experience. We're all humans. It's a planet. You know, it's just, wow.
Yeah. Definitely not the location that, you know, 18 or 19 year old, you know, artists from rural Vermont thinks he's going to have his first hit.
Yeah.
You know, I think he was on the airplane to Australia 6 times that year. You know, it's a 14-hour flight.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But the new artist Grammy nomination. So you were telling me that you've never been in this position before.
No, best new artist, Big Four category. It's huge and really, really difficult to get here. So not, you know, we're just trying to enjoy it. And the Grammys are next week, and so I think. You know, it's a career defining moment. And like, there's a lot of things that you do in your day-to-day life that are really rewarding and compelling and you're proud of, but there are so few things that you can, you know, your kids will tell their kids about. And they could say at some point, like, you know, remember when whatever, you know, Noah was Grammy nominated, or, you know, insert artist here was, you know, won a Grammy.
Right.
So there is those kind of just like headline moments that you can look back on, and the Grammys are that for music. So it's also just a fun celebration to what has been great a year and a half of incredibly hard work. So
yeah, and great partying.
I'll tell you once afterwards. I don't know.
How much of a fashion guy are you? Like, what are you wearing?
I like to you know, wear something nice, but I'm not, you know, high fashion by any means.
Yeah, I mean, not like haute couture or something, but still, you know, it's like, hey, there'll be some pictures.
Fun.
Yeah, it's totally fun. That's so great, man. I'm psyched for you. So Live Nation, but talk to me about how now, and give me a little bit of background on Foundations, artist management, and how that all started and where you are today, you know, from that perspective.
Yeah. So when I worked for Mark Cates at Fenway, I went from Boston, kind of got small, and I wanted to experience something beyond Boston. I was there for a total of 6 years, so a couple years after school. And I'd met Steve Bursky, who was my current partner at Foundations now. Mm-hmm. And he started Foundations from his dorm room at UPenn. And I started managing bands out of my dorm room at Northeastern. And we had met when I was working for Live Nation in a production capacity, because he was managing the band Dispatch, who he manages to this day. Mm-hmm. And Dispatch was coming up through Boston, and they were having this huge cultural moment around the Napster file sharing era. And so I worked all the shows that Dispatch did, and I noticed he was a young manager. And so we just became friends. And when I was looking to leave Boston and move to New York, he at the time was operating Foundations out of New York, and I hit him up and I was like, hey, you know, you have a job for me? And at the time, the band I was managing in college had broken up, kind of went their own ways post-college. And he's like, you don't have any clients. So no, but, you know, so, but he said, hey, I'm actually currently renting office space. He was subletting office space from James Brown's management team. And, you know, he's like, I think the James Brown team is looking to hire a day-to-day manager. So I interviewed for that job and fortunately got that job. And that was what got me to move to New York. And so I was really fortunate to have the opportunity to work on the James Brown team and learn, and then also be across the office from my friend and Steve. Yeah. So,
this was like 2005 ish, right? I think if I didn't calculate it right.
2005, 2006.
Uh-huh. I think. Yeah.
And so working for James Brown, I was the youngest person on the team. You know, at this point I was 24, I think 23. Uh-huh. I was eyes wide open, just absorbing it all, right? Like, you don't have the opportunity to be in the vicinity of a global icon like that very often, let alone be on the inside circle. Right. And, you know, so I, unfortunately, my time there was cut short because he passed away. So I worked for the company for about a year and a half, and I got the phone call, I think it was on Christmas Eve, that I had to come back to New York and plan his funeral. And so at the time, I remember I didn't own a suit. And
that's the last thing you think you're going to be doing when you're doing artist management. I mean, that's kind of like on the bottom of the list. That's the last bullet point on the list. If they haven't fired you and they pass away, you're going to have to deal with their memorial.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and just to be clear, like, I was not the person that was directly responsible for that. Right. I was the person who was the lowest on the ladder, but, you know, I had to come back for the funeral and get logistics underway and start planning the whole thing. And I didn't own a suit, so the my boss at the time, he was like, "Hey, here's some money. Go buy a suit." Yeah. And then it was a white horse drawn carriage through Harlem and a whole experience. It was at the Apollo Theater, and Al Sharpton was, you know, presiding over it. And it was a wild,
have a front row seat to all that. I was like, wow, just that.
Oh yeah. Just that alone was, you know, walking behind the carriage through Harlem was just wild. Holy so, shit. But at the time he had had a whole year of tour dates booked. Like, he was truly the hardest working man in show business still. And so it was unexpected and was quite an interesting shift in my career too, because
you learned how to unwind things.
Well, I witnessed the chaos.
Well,
right?
You first met, the only reason I said this, cause you said he had a year worth of tour dates. That has had to be all unwound. It's obviously.
Oh yeah. That whole thing. And, and then it's the estate battle, and, you know, again, I was not privy to details of that whole thing, but it was just seeing what happens when you have this really culture changing intellectual property that exists and it goes beyond someone's lifespan. And, you know, it didn't even dawn on me at that point in my career. I was so young, and to think, like, this, you know, this has a value culturally. So, and you have to assess that, and who owns it, and who directs it, and who's the, you know, executor.
That's interesting perspective, because that's something that's really driving kind of, you know, artists as they get into their careers and have all this intellectual property, so to speak, to own, and that they are purveyors of, and they need to be rewarded for that. Did that give you kind of an insight into that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And more than anything, I was just thankful to have had the time I had with someone who was truly, you know, global superstar, and, you know, one of the people who changed music, you know, and changed culture. And,
of course.
I also was working on a band at the time that were based out of Netherlands, out of Amsterdam, called Voiced. And so it gave me a chance to go over, and they were another client of the company, and go over to Europe for the first time, you know, professionally, and work with international artists as well. So, it was a short period of time, but a quick learning experience for me. And again, proximity to my current business partner now at Foundations was really important. And so I got to know Steve better, and my other partner, Brian Winton. And when James Brown passed away, it was turmoil, and the company's main client. So I was looking for another role, and I ended up at Red Light Management. Red Light was run by Corin Capshaw, and at the time they were in the beginning stages of building what is now the biggest company in artist management. And I didn't have a client still, because I was still doing day to day. So I hit up my buddy Steve again, and I was like, "Hey, I think this is gonna. I need a new gig." And he was like, "You don't have a client still." So I went to Red Light and worked on a band called OAR, and they were signed to Atlantic Records. And they're, you know, at the time, you know, amphitheater in type of size act, but totally independent, similar to Ani DiFranco, which had a lot of parallels there, just in business structure and as far as, like, you know, philosophy behind the business. So that was a fun time too. And I kind of watched from the inside how Red Light Management was growing. And about 3 years went by before I signed my first artist, which was a band called Young the Giant. And so Young the Giant was kind of my first, you know, personal, you know, breakout. And at that time I reached out to Steve again, and I said, "Hey, I got a client." And, you know, so I joined Foundations then. It was 2010. So
when you're working with Red Light and you sign an artist, that's your artist and you can go wherever you want with it?
Not particularly. No, they definitely wouldn't want, that would want me to say that. But because of the structure of how I was there, I was an employee of the company. I was working day to day on somebody else's client. And the intention of when I got hired there was, I want to be able to go sign my own client eventually. And that time came, and you know, between me and my immediate boss, it was agreed upon to go do that. But the company as a whole had a bigger agenda, right? So we discussed a deal for me to stay at Red Light, and it just didn't make sense at the time. And so I kind of had a bit more of an entrepreneurial vision for myself, and I was been wanting to work with my friend for years. And so it kind of just was the right time to go make that leap.
That was when you were already you had already like approached Young the Giant from a personal perspective.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I didn't mean to say anything about like Red Light or whatever, how that went, but it sounded like you had already kind of had them when you were under the umbrella of Red Light. So I wondered how that worked.
Yeah. About a year passed between when I was pursuing them, which was all known within the company, but it just took time for them to get my deal in place and for it to be prioritized and for us to negotiate.
And by that time you were already just with Steve and kind of starting to do your own thing.
No, at that time, over that year, I intended to do a deal at Red Light, and then it at some point in the process became clear that I want to do something else. And that's when I went to Steve and said, "It looks like it's not going to happen here, you know.
Yeah.
Would you want to?"
Why was Red Light not like a good place for you personally?
It wasn't that it wasn't a good place, it's a great place, and there's business happening there that was far beyond my experience, and I had a lot to learn and was appreciative of being there. I think it was just this desire I had to do my own thing and create my own brand, and I felt like the Foundations brand was existed prior to me, but I felt like it was still small and growing. And I think that back to the human nature of what management is, I really wanted to work closely with a group of friends that I really, you know, I really thought we were on the same level. We can learn together. We're the same age. You know, I'd respected what Steve had done for a long time. And it just felt like it was the right thing for me at that time in my life.
And then, and that's when you sort of, is that kind of when you sort of, when you met Noah, just to kind of bring it full circle?
No, I met Noah, in 2000, what time? Let me try to think here. It was 2015 when I met Noah. So, I was managing on the Giant for a while. I managed them for 13 years until yeah. last year, actually. And the process of finding Noah, I was also working on a band called Luis Del Mar at the time. And they had gotten signed to a record deal at Columbia and, you know, were touring and in the festival circuit and on radio and the whole thing. And I was kind of dabbling with explore a couple other, you know, developing projects. And then I came across Noah and then around that same time or shortly after that, I started working with, a band called Coin and then Dayglow as well. So, but all throughout that, our, you know, we're, you know, Steve, Brian and I were kind of overseeing our company and growing the personnel there and other younger managers at the company. And, I moved to Nashville in 2014, and opened the office here in Nashville, and I've been here since.
Yeah. And when someone like Noah gets so big, do you sort of expand your own team to accommodate those kind of, like, I'm sure just the needs kind of grow as well, but then you've got your own list of clients that you're working with, you know, apart from, you know, the entire client list at Foundation. So how does that kind of, factor in, like, you know, you're doing, there's just so, you like this huge client, but you're also with Dayglow and Coin and others. How do you manage that and keep everybody happy? Is that a challenge for you?
A daily challenge. Yeah. You know, there's, we, artists will create when they feel inspired or when they have opportunity to, and that doesn't always align with, you know, your bandwidth, right? So, you know, especially when COVID hit, you know, everyone stopped touring, everyone went home, everyone kind of got caught up to speed together. And then simultaneously, when the world opened up again, they all put music out around the same time. Yeah. So that last year and a half, 2 years, you know, back into culture or into society again, was a burst of new music because artists were at home creating and writing, and that's all they could do.
So it's like the floodgates opened. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
How did that line, how does that line, when you, so let's talk about that for a second though, because that's interesting. Like, I constantly think about that these days when we're still kind of feeling we're still in the wake of the pandemic, and those waves are getting a little smaller as the boat sails farther down, you know, like, fuck that analogy, but you know what I'm talking about, right? But, and how did you, at the beginning, it's like, you're going to send everybody out on tour at the same time, or like, how did you, did you sort of think like, this will kind of, because you have like artistic human development also, and like artistic, not everyone's going to have that same time frame of creativity, but you kind of did during pandemic. Now everyone's wants to go out at the same time. Did that eventually even out, so you don't have artists doing all the same things at the same time?
This year it has, but the last 2 years was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I had the same time, the same fall, I had Yon the Giant touring, putting on a record, Coin and Dayglow both touring on new records, and Noah touring in what ended up becoming the tour that he was kind of testing out, Stick Season. So,
so at the end of that, you kind of like go home and like, please, can someone just take a little bit longer to create the next album? And can we just kind of, can we kind of stagger this a little? Do you have like an idol at home that you pray to so that things just kind of get staggered in the future?
Yeah, I
guess
wish.
That's a good problem to have, right?
It is, yeah. And you have to manage your own bandwidth. It's, you know, like any business ownership, you have to, you know, balance your cash flow and balance your you know, bandwidth and your personnel.
Hire good people too, which kind of also becomes full circle. Now you're in the position where you're hiring like you know, past yous, right?
Yeah, that's a really fulfilling thing. I think I've really enjoyed that in being able to. We've had a deep history actually at our company of interns becoming, you know, valuable contributors to our team, and you know,
well that's a you know, total tribute to choosing the right people and seeing. It's kind of like a self-filtering though, right? I mean, people, it's hard. And they probably come in the door and the good ones stay because they're good at it, but they also just were suited for it, perhaps.
Yeah. And when you find good people, you have to keep them around, you know, and that's what's going to be, you know, help create culture at a company. So,
yeah. But, one other aspect was that, and so now you're in Nashville. So you started an arm of Foundations in Nashville. How, like, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. Nashville was transitioning from, you know, everyone thinking of it as just country music. And frankly, you know, the songwriters and producers and the infrastructure here being so country dominant, for so long. And, I think it's just globalization of, you know, of music and desire for people to, you know,
also, like more diverse artists moving to Nashville too, kind of like popularizes the notion that it's not just country.
Absolutely. You know, there's proof of concept here. And I think, artistry always seeks affordability. And I think there's a long history of that.
Yeah, but it's sort of not, it's becoming almost like a thing of the past in Nashville to hear everyone that's living there talking about it.
Yeah. The last 10 years has changed a lot, yes. Yeah. But that's no different than, you know, what Brooklyn was at one point, you know.
True,
and
true.
So I think, you know, there's always a desire to have space to create and, you know, the mental capacity to create. And I think that Nashville offered some conveniences that were really, you know, comfortable for a lot of artists. And we just kind of identified that was happening here, and it happened to coincide with my wife and I, you know, kind of seeking something else besides New York. And so Nashville has grown a lot since we moved here, and the industry is diversified entirely, which just makes it easier to do this job and to work in music. And, you know, I think healthcare and music are the two biggest sectors in Nashville. So it's also located centrally in America, and that makes it kind of easy between LA and New York, and get to London pretty easily. So yeah, a lot of benefits to being in Nashville, but it was, you know, partially a desire to try something new.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's got a great airport there, so you can get in and out quickly.
Yes.
Which is always important.
It's convenient.
Yeah, totally. Before I let you go, and you know, you have such an incredible, this 2024 is going to be an amazing year for you, clearly. But I want to talk about just a little bit before I let you go about the Busyhead project, the nonprofit project that Noah started and that has been kind of really gained momentum. And you've managed to raise an amazing amount of money. It started out with like a goal of $1 million, just a low goal of $1 million, and got to like more than two. It's probably even more now. And I guess from my understanding, like $1 from every ticket at some point, or just going forward, like gets donated to this. You want to talk a little bit about what it is, and also this kind of the ticket donation component as well, and what it means to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So mental health has been super important to Noah, and he speaks a lot about it at every show. He talks about it, and you know, he was fortunate to be in a family that was really supportive and understanding of mental health challenges. And you know, as he had his, as lots of people do, as he had his challenges growing up, he was able to access therapy, and he really, you know, speaks every day about how that changed his life, and it gave him life, and allowed him to have the confidence to do what he's doing now. And so it was really essential to his existence, and in, you know, just kind of being the grounded person he is, was really intent on wanting to give back and wanting to create the opportunity he had for people that may have not been in such supportive families, or have not been in an area that had the resources for it, and or may not even know that they needed therapy, and the benefits that can come from the variety of different types of therapy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we kind of made it like any artist, you sit down and you say, what are your goals? What do you want to do? What do you want to you know, what kind of footprint do you want to leave in this world? And for Noah, it was creating opportunity to gain access to resources of mental health. And there's a coexistence so much of nonprofits in art. And I think in this one, you know, we get hit up all the time for a variety of our artists that, you know, there's this charity, that charity to benefit, you know, whatever it might be, you know, do we want to put on a concert for it or donate tickets or, you know, provide t-shirts for it or whatever it might be. And, I wanted to kind of funnel his energy and kind of suggestion I always have for artists is funnel your energy into what's most important for you. Right. And that was, the origin of Busyhead. And I was like, hey, we should do this thing and see if we can donate a portion of your proceeds, and make it ongoing, make it a career long endeavor. And so, yeah, $1 for every ticket. And also a portion of, other parts of ticket sales go towards, you know, a fund, which is currently a donor advised fund that, we distribute resources locally in the regions that we tour. So our thought was, as you go through these markets, don't just collect the money and, you know, put it towards one national organization. You have a portion of the funds go to local organizations that we identify.
That's a lot of organizations, a lot of cities. I mean, your calendar is stacked in 2024 already.
Yeah, and it's become global, and we're doing it around the world. And you know, so you have to find these organizations, which we partner with a company called SaleWorks, who do this. This is their core job. They link artists with you know, charitable organizations. And they've run the Ally Coalition for Jack Antonoff, and they work with Boy Genius and Phoebe Bridgers, and they help to kind of vet the local organizations, so we know that the money's going into good hands. And then we have a couple of national organizations that the other portion of the money goes to, so that you know, we can kind of have the big resources and the smaller localized resources. But you know, we have big plans for it, and every branding deal that Noah does has to incorporate some contribution to Busyhead Fund.
Oh, that's cool.
So that, you know, he's kind of putting his money where his mouth is. So whenever we do deals, you know, we make sure that that's front and center. And we set a goal of middle of last year. We launched it in May of last year to raise $1 million. At the time, we didn't want to put a time frame on it because we didn't know, you know. And we raised $1 million in 6 months, and then we're now surpassing 2 million, and I think by the end of 2024 might be at 5 million. So like our goal is to make as much of an impact as we can.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're donating $1 for every ticket sale, just the Fenway, you know, $120,000 tickets over two nights, you're a tenth of the way to a million, or you know, whatever. Like that's a lot. I mean, and I love that concept of just like not blowing in and out of a city, but giving it some attention for the cause that you feel is important.
Yeah, exactly. It's I think a lot of people perceive artists as like dropping into their town and moving on, right? Yeah. But that relationship with the people that live in that city is important, and you know, the resources they have are different than the next town on the tour stop. So, right. It felt like it was a really important part of the kind of mantra of the company or the entity.
So individuals already know that they are donating $1 for the ticket sales, or that Noah's and the organization is donating $1 to the Busyhead project with each ticket, but others can also find in more information about Busyhead through, I think it's on the website, Noah's website itself, to donate separately and individually if you'd like to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can receive funds. That's great. Similar to a GoFundMe if you want to just go on there and make a donation. So
mental health is important. I talk about it a lot on this show, and especially for touring artists that are well familiar with mental health issues. It takes a huge toll on artists, and also not to mention just everybody, and everyone struggles with it from time to time, and it's good to have people to talk to.
Absolutely. And there's some amazing organizations that are for the touring industry that are focusing for therapy for the touring personnel, which we're bringing a therapist out on Noah's next tour, right, to address the mental health of our crew, because it's not just the artist, it's the entire operation out there. So, yeah. I think we're seeing more and more of that as time goes on, which is really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's great. Well, this has been great, Drew, putting just a human face on the management, industry.
Oh, thanks. It's awesome talking to you as well.
Yeah, it was really great. Good luck. This year is going to be exciting. I'm psyched for you. February, is it the 2nd, 3rd, 4th? February 4th, I think, Grammys?
February 4th.
Yeah, yep. Amazing. Good luck with that. Good luck to Noah.
Thank you.
And this is going to be a huge year for you, and I'll be thinking about you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Great to have you on the show. Thanks again, brother.
All right, thanks. All right, bye-bye. Cheers.
Okay, that was Drew Simmons of Foundations Artist Management. I'm so happy that I was able to have Drew on the show. I really enjoyed that interview with him, and I just love to be able to bring artist managers on the show, and especially one like Drew at this point in his career and his life, managing Noah Kahan with all the success that Noah has had recently. It's just extra interesting because we see what it looks like at the top, and you know, of course, there's a lot of work to be done, and Noah has a long career ahead of him, as we talked about. But, you know, looking down and drilling down at this story, it's really quite amazing how Drew discovered Noah's music, just like we all do. You know, he was happened to be on SoundCloud, saw the song Sync, really loved it. I believe it was that song. Drove up to contacted Noah, who didn't really believe it. You know, you guys heard the story, drove up there, and I guess that was about 9 years ago, and the rest is history. You know, that's an incredible success story of one particular manager and his client. But as we heard, you know, Drew had been in the business for you know, almost the majority of his life, growing up in Buffalo, working his way up through, working with Annie DeFranco. You know, he was with a number of different companies in Boston, working at different jobs, security, working at the door. He had worked at box offices, I think, when he was in high school back in Buffalo, just doing everything, seeing the business from so many different angles. Really quite interesting from that perspective. He also worked with James Brown shortly before James Brown died, and you know, to give him insight into the organization of a global superstar at that point, and having to be there at the time with the memorial service, etc. Just really interesting. And you know, not only is he managing the business aspects, but you know how Drew talked about working for artists, humans. You know, we sometimes forget that. You know, while also keeping an eye on the business side, of course. You know, he likened it to parenting, really, to a large extent. You know, and there is that kind of fine line between sort of having to crack the whip and be that business person and take care of the artist as a whole human entity and guide and move that art forward. You know, he really said he enjoyed to be able to impact the art and at the same time advocate for the artist. I think that he is really great at that. And I was glad that we were able to dig in and dissect that and discuss it. And of course, Noah's just had an amazing 2023, one of the most popular artists of that year, and was also nominated for Best New Artist in the recent Grammys that just happened last month. Just absolutely amazing. And of course, the mega popular North American and European tours that Noah is embarking on is just absolutely amazing. The two Fenway shows, two shows at Fenway Park in Boston that sold out in kind of Noah's backyard, as well as two nights sold out at Madison Square Garden, among other venues, just playing around the country with sold out shows. Just absolutely incredible. So glad you were here for this one. And don't forget to also support the Busy Head Project, which seeks to raise mental health awareness and raises money for that by donating a portion of ticket sales to local mental health organizations in the cities where Noah plays. So that's just wonderful. I really love that. Again, that was Drew Simmons, Foundations artist management. So happy you were along for this one. I got a number of different amazing interviews already in the queue. Can't wait to share those with you. Follow us on the socials, especially Instagram, for updates on upcoming artists and upcoming guests and other great things that are happening at Roadcase. Thanks again for your support and thanks again for being here. And I want to send a special shout out to the amazing Drew Simmons of Foundations Artist Management for being here on this episode of Roadcase. Thanks again so much for listening. And I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Roadcase. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. And we have a YouTube channel called Roadcase Podcast. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Roadcase. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.